a flawed judiciary, human rights abuses in an absolute monarch would normally start serious debate and condemnation here at Westminster, but not when the country in question is Saudi Arabia. On this week's Big Story, we ask, why is Saudi Arabia Britain's special case?
This relationship did not serve the interest of the people.
Saudi Arabia, together with quite a few other countries, are listed by the Foreign Office as countries of concern because their human rights record is not good, and yet we continue to sell them arms.
They are, if you like, for want of a better word, clients or agents of colonial powers in the Middle East.
Saudi Arabia has long been a staunch ally for Britain and America. In a deal that developed into its modern form in the 1960s, the House of Saud guarantees a continuing supply of oil for the West, and in return the West supports this authoritarian power. At the same time, the West turns a blind eye to the darker side of the Saudi regime, and it's reluctant to do anything that might upset its most vital of allies. Yet with the coming of the Arab Spring, an increasing level of dissent is being seen within the kingdom.
What would be these grievances?
Well, there are so many grievances. Some of them related to the living standards, some of them related to public services. But the most important is the grievance, the political grievance, that the people failed to participate in the government for decades, and it is now time for them to have a say in the political system.
Unfortunately, the nature of power in Saudi Arabia is so concentrated, it hasn't ever really been affected by a kind of significant reform movement. As recently as the 1990s, it expelled the people who set up the first opposition party, run by people like Professor Al-Masari, who is now in the United Kingdom. And again, a few months ago, when another party was set up, it was banned the very next day. Its leaders and main figures were imprisoned. And we have a situation again where there just isn't any movement. Power is within a clique, and it does the bidding of the people that it's allied with, and doesn't have a relationship, political or otherwise, with the people who live there.
Widespread human rights abuses and a judicial system that bears nothing in common with even partial democracies make for a situation that is particularly hard for outsiders to understand.
We're standing in front of the Saudi embassy in one of London's smartest districts. But how much do we really know about the regime that the men and the women who work inside this building represent?
If you ask about which legal protection or legal rights are in Saudi Arabia, then let me tell you the real description, which a European, someone grown and educated in Europe will appreciate that, is to compare Saudi Arabia with some European countries in the time past. Once the Wall Street Journal, a writer there, said, the Saudis are our friends, oil is very important, we have somehow to deal with them, although we know that they are in the historic level of King Henry VIII. Actually, he was quite optimistic. My belief firmly is that they are the historic level of Edward III, Longshank. I'm taking Edward III specifically because we saw him in Braveheart. Although some people say it's not historical 100%, but let's assume it's a little bit historical. You have seen the king going there, not happy with the friend of his son, who seems to be a little bit gay, and throw him out of the window. So the king is the executioner, the judge, he's absolute. Nobody can ask him. He has the right to throw you out of the window. You are dead. There's no check of that. The Saudi regime is at that level. The king can very easily kill this man. He's causing a secession in the land. That's enough, and you'll be get killed.
We have tens or hundreds of political prisoners in the Saudi jails, and some of them spent more than 15 years just because they express their views explicitly and publicly. And yesterday, a man just called for reforms, and he was arrested. It's very easy in Saudi Arabia to be arrested if you ask for reforms, while the government or high princes would say no. So it is the kingdom of silence, as one human rights organization described it.
Yes, they claim they have a judiciary which is Islamic, and you may refer to the judiciary, but a phone call from the local governor, like Salman, the governor of Riyadh, in my case, for example, to the head of the court, saying there's a case and so on of Mas'al, yes, case number so on, close the case and send it to my office. Case for done, because he's above the law and he's above the judiciary. So if someone says these people are detained without trial, and they say, which trial? The local governor and the princes and the king, they have the right of trial. There's no jury given. So you will get hung on a royal order without any issue. Like, for example, the coup d'etat against King Faisal in the year 69. There was an attempt at coup d'etat, and one prince was involved, his brother Mish'al. Mish'al was spared because he's a royal, but the others were executed the same night by order of the king. So he's the judge and the executioner. The same. He did not hold the sword in his hand. He was too weak to do that, but his executioner did it the same night. No need for any trial whatsoever, because he's the judge. He's the supreme judge, he's the supreme executioner, he's the supreme solicitor general.
That is still the case?
That's still essentially the case. That's essentially the case. Although some technicalities and some formalities of the law are there, but they are just neglecting them, putting them out of sight, because nobody can enforce them. There's no accountability, there's no elected assembly who can ask about that, and there is no judiciary who will dare confronting that.
Now, when you don't really have systematic legal protection for people in a country, whether it's in the main legal code or for the sort of stateless beings, if you like, who are on these kind of work permits that could be terminated at any minute, thus meaning loss of financial income, you're finding people just working away, being abused, with women actually often being subjected to rape, or if they're not sexually abused, they'll be working 18-hour days, maybe even more. Sometimes not paid, almost kept in a sort of enslaved type of scenario, mm-hmm. Where there have been rapes and there have been pregnancies, or let's say pregnancies have occurred, things like this, or there have been accusations of sexual misdemeanor. You can find yourselves hauled up in front of judges who really, even within the constitution of Saudi Arabia, aren't practicing the law of the country, and yet will be happily meeting out all sorts of capital types of punishment, not necessarily death, but lashings or other types of quite hard sentences. Mm-hmm. And there isn't a sort of recourse in law. There are, in fairness, facets of the Saudi law, legal system, which say you can appeal. These types of safeguards are here, there and everywhere. But in practice, these things are very rarely adhered to. I mean, we've dealt with many, many cases, actually not even so much within the migrant workers section, but within people who are Saudi nationals, where even their original hearing, based on the charge they had, was not prosecuted properly. There was no due process, even by the law of that country, which mm-hmm. we are critical of. So there is a bit of, if you like, a free-for-all when it comes to the legal system.
But it's a very good time to meet.
Every British Prime Minister must meet regularly with representatives from the Saudi royal family. Whatever concerns leading politicians might have regarding the relationship with the country are quickly put aside in the name of business. It's difficult to avoid the conclusion that profits are being put before people. This footage was shot in Qatif, in the east of the country, though similar protests have been reported throughout Saudi Arabia. The crowd is using the same slogans as their counterparts in Tunisia and Egypt, as well as demanding the release of political prisoners. As with other protests, this crowd was met with tear gas and live rounds fired by the police. Central to Britain and America's interaction with Saudi has been the dealing of massive amounts of arms. The UK is the world's fourth largest provider of arms for export, a trade that increases as each year passes and is now worth approaching £10 billion to the UK economy.
Does Saudi Arabia feature on the campaign against the arms trade's radar?
Oh, very, very much so. And the reason is because we've sold huge amounts of weapons to Saudi Arabia. In fact, it's a priority market for the British government's arms sales unit, which is part of UK Trade and Investment. It's called the Defence and Security Organisation. And Saudi Arabia is top of the list. But it's also top of our list for other reasons as well. It's one of the major markets for BAE Systems, which British government, Saudi Arabia government and BAE Systems are linked together in a rather unholy sort of trinity when it comes to arms sales. So we're very concerned about arms sales to Saudi Arabia for all sorts of reasons.
When you say priority market for British arms, what does that mean?
Well, first of all, let's just go back a few years. Britain has been selling arms in quite a big way to the Saudis since the 1960s. But the real push came in the mid-1980s when there was a series of arms deals called Yamama, which means the dove. Now, these involved what was then called British Aerospace, and which is now called BAE Systems, which is Britain's largest arms company, but primarily were government-to-government negotiations between the British government and the Saudi government. And under this deal, Britain would deliver massive amounts of military hardware, largely made by British Aerospace, to the Saudi government. This was a deal that ran into billions and billions of pounds, and which at the time was hailed as the biggest arms deal in British history, and I think it still is. And the ramifications of that deal have rippled through the succeeding quarter of a century for all sorts of reasons. First of all, it had, from the beginning, allegations of corrupt practices attached to it. Secondly, because we looked at the weapons we were selling Saudi Arabia and people were saying, why are we selling to the Saudis? They're an undemocratic, authoritarian regime. What on earth are they going to be using those weapons for? And thirdly, because this deal was talked up by the British media and the defence establishment as being economically incredibly important to Britain. And we don't think it was. We don't think it was then, and we certainly don't think it's now. It's been greatly exaggerated. And nor is it actually very good for Saudi Arabia to be spending vast amounts of money on weapons when it could be using that money to support general welfare within the Saudi Arabian people and also, you know, within the Arab world. So there's all sorts of reasons why it's been controversial and upsetting.
The Al Yamama arms deal soon became a byword for corruption as allegations emerged of a slush fund designed to provide sweetness for Saudi officials. You could be forgiven for thinking that the Saudi Arabian royal family were planning for an enormous war, given their prodigious consumption of Western-made arms. The very latest in military technology features in continuing arms deals, with the kingdom regularly topping the list of British arms industry's top consumers.
Why do they spend so much money on arms? Who are they fighting?
I think the military expenditure has different or a number of goals. One of the goals is to pay off for their alliance, their coalition with the West, their in a strategic relationship with the West. They have to buy arms in return of selling oil to the West. This is one major goal and one major aim for the West, and one major maybe a requirement for the royal family in Saudi Arabia.
So rather than being in desperate need of these weapons, the consumption of Western-made arms is an essential part of the mutual agreement between Britain and Saudi Arabia. Arms sales with payment in oil, a keystone of the delicately balanced relationship that keeps the oil flowing west and the political support heading east.
Do we believe these trade deals have any influence on the kind of criticism that comes out of Downing Street on what the Saudis do in the Middle East, in Bahrain?
Well, we make very few criticisms of Saudi Arabia. And I would say that, in fact, it seems that British governments are quite worried about Saudi Arabia. And perhaps I should need to go back to 2006. At that time, the Serious Fraud Office, the British Financial Criminal Investigation Office, was investigating BAE Systems in allegations of corruption, payments made corruptly in Saudi Arabia and several other countries. When they actually got as far as investigating Swiss bank accounts, the Saudis came to the British government and said, if you go any further, we won't give you intelligence information on Al-Qaeda and other aspects which might threaten Britain. And the then British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, personally ordered the Serious Fraud Office to pull the investigation, to stop the investigation. Now, that was very serious. What they were saying, in effect, was that the Saudi Arabian concerns had precedence over the rule of law in Britain.
How much is this worth to Saudi Arabia, the trade between the countries? What are they getting out of this deal?
Well, the main objective for the Saudis, the main benefit for the royal family in Saudi Arabia is to maintain their throne, the maintain their power, to prolong the age of their government in this region, and this is their strategic view and strategic plan for their relationship with the West as a whole.
Extensive investigations into the conduct of arms deal have been undertaken and have often been allowed to run on for decades due to the murky nature of the industry. After more than 20 years of denying wrongdoings in connection with sales to Saudi Arabia and other countries, BAE Systems was finally made to pay £300 million in penalties. £300 million might sound like a lot, but put it in context of the scale of the BAE System contracts, it represents a drop in the ocean.
But if we know about their poor human rights record, why are we doing business with them?
That's imperial interests. Possibly these various well-established rights here in Britain and in the West, especially Britain and America being countries which are based on common law and the Anglo-Saxon tradition of the law. I think it's painful to say that, but we have sometimes to be painful, even to the British public, to awaken to the reality and ask themselves what we are really believing, what's our belief about this, what the limitation. Churchill is on record in the 1922, when he used nerve gas, mustard gas, against the Kurdish rebels. Some moralists in the parliament, so we have moralists here, who thinks about human rights universally, they were upset and they questioned that. And Churchill answered the following, say, I am amazed that some respectable members of this respectable house are worried about using of nerve gas or mustard gas against savages. So let's ask the British politician at least, not the British public. I think the public is much more innocent than that. But some of the public may be. We never know. Are you still believing that those who are non-Anglo-Saxon, not WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, the WASPs, the famous abbreviation in America, they have any rights? They are not just savages or insects which you can use mustard gas against them? Are that's truly what you believe and your politics is based on that? I have greatest doubt that the politician look at the rest of the world, especially the third world, especially the Muslim world, as more, no more than savages and insects. You can use that. So they say, who cares? This is an ant hive. Is it called hive or ant colony? Colony. I think it's a beehive or something. And managed by an absolute ant queen. They are ants. We have nothing to do with them except that they are bees. They deliver for us honey. As long as we get the honey, we don't care the less what is the social structure of the hive or the colony. That's it. It seems to me that's the real motivation. It's purely imperial politics, and I think what you hear about human rights and so on, they believe sincerely for themselves.
Saudi Arabia, together with quite a few other countries, are listed by the Foreign Office as countries of concern because their human rights record is not good, and yet we continue to sell them arms. If you actually look at the government's own regulation on arms export licenses, we are not supposed to export to countries who have poor human rights records or who are likely to use weaponry to suppress their own populations. But what we've seen, particularly over the last few months, is that we have sold weapons to countries who violate both of those conditions, who have specifically used British weapons in order to mow down peaceful demonstrators. So I think there has always been that double standard there with Saudi Arabia and many other countries.
The Arab Spring has reminded Britain just how important it is to back the winning side in these turbulent times. While Saudi Arabia is a key ally for the UK, internal unrest presents a particularly difficult problem.
There seems to be radio silence from Westminster about Saudi Arabia's human rights track record. What do you put that down to?
Saudi Arabia does a good job for its allies in terms of keeping not only its internal political situation very closely clamped down on, therefore ensuring favourable oil deals and obviously spending lots of money on arms, etc. There is also the issue that they interfere in other countries. We've seen it just now with Bahrain. They have actually ensured that a country which is housing one of the largest bases, military bases of the United States, is protected from a popular uprising revolution. I mean, to characterize what's happening in Bahrain that way makes it sound like there's some kind of armed rebellion going on. In fact, what you're having is a peaceful movement that could very well overthrow the ruling interest there. And yet we've seen Saudi troops go in. We can only guess at who's bidding to actually help crush that. So it has that kind of role. It is, if you like, an enforcer, or you know, it can provide a gun for hire within the region.
In the past, documentaries have shown that BAE tried to sell electric shock batons to Saudi Arabia. These are exactly the kinds of weapons that could be used for torture. And given the total absence of a recall to justice for those who find themselves on the wrong side of the royal family, many have been critical of BAE's open policy.
One of the things I'd like to just emphasise is when it comes to the British side, I hardly think human rights and ethics ever came into it at all. I found a very interesting quote by Michael Heseltine, who was Minister for Defence in the mid-1980s, and he said in 1989, well, the Saudis wanted to buy kit, we've got it to sell, so I don't see why we shouldn't sell it to them. It's very, very pragmatic. It was seen not, the whole considerations about human rights, ethics really didn't come into it at all. It was seen as a good deal on both sides. We don't think it was a good deal either for the Saudis or for the British, but that was hardly discussed at the time.
The Al Yamama deal alone has brought the company around £43 billion, and the paltry size of the penalty is seen by some as indicative of the government's overriding desire to allow arms producers to continue their work.
So my feeling is that all the attempts to save these regimes, and some of them at least, will fail. Gaddafi is on the way out sooner or later. Egypt will transform better and better. Yemen is on the way. Bahrain, being a small country with the issues of sectarian problems there, and Saudi Arabia and the base there, may be delayed, but it will be like a footnote of the whole development. Saudi Arabia is in real danger, the regime in real danger of collapse, especially if Yemen, the regime in Yemen collapses, then there will be enormous waves coming from Yemen and strength. So they will have to review their politics and change radically. Or they will have to face economic and political consequences of unforeseeable level, especially if we have a major world economic crisis like many people are expecting. Then I think the coming years will be of utmost bleak development, which may be lead to major conflicts and wars, because nobody is able to manage anything and nobody is willing to admit the past mistakes. And it sounds like really religious and philosophical to repent and say, I made a mistake, I honestly regret it, I'm going to improve it. For that, you need people of really such internal high moral values, which we don't have in current days politicians, unfortunately. They don't have that. None of them is willing to say for us, listen people, what I did there is a mistake, not a mistake, it's a crime. I repent to God, I resign, I suggest this and this. Can you expect that from anyone who is less than the Messiah or less than the Mahdi? I don't expect it from them.
So whilst the relationship between Britain and Saudi Arabia is one that clearly aims to suit those who run both nations, the Desert Kingdom remains an enigma to many. With countries like Britain having supported this corrupt and intolerant royal family for decades, it's far from clear that any replacement government with a greater degree of democracy would want to deal with nations that have embraced such a two-faced foreign policy.